Mark Feinsand, executive reporter for MLB.com. Welcome to the Executive Access Podcast. Before we get to this week's episode, a word from our sponsor. Erectile dysfunction is more common than you might think. 52% of men over 40 will experience ED at some point, and about 75% of those men don't seek treatment. That's why Roman makes it easy to get expert treatment from a U.S. licensed physician all online. No judgment, no hassle, no hours spent in the waiting room. With Roman, you get expert medical care for ED right in the comfort and privacy of your own home. Everything is online, so it's convenient and discreet to contact a doctor about prescription medication. Getting started is simple. Just go to GetRoman.com/major and complete an online visit with your medical history and symptoms. A licensed physician will evaluate your online visit and let you know within 24 hours if medication is right for you. If prescribed by the doctor, Roman delivers genuine medication right to your door with free two-day shipping. Just go to GetRoman.com/major to get a free online visit and a free two-day shipping. That's GetRoman.com/major to get started with a free online visit. That's GetRoman.com/major. Mike Elias began his career as an area scout for the St. Louis Cardinals, moving to the Houston Astros when Jeff Luhnow took over as general manager. In Houston, Elias ran the club's amateur scouting department, playing a major role in the Astros' rebuild that led to the team's first World Series title in 2017. Elias joined the Baltimore Orioles last November as executive vice president and general manager, embarking on another major rebuilding project. I sat down with Elias to discuss amateur scouting, player development, the difficulties of going through a rebuild, and much more. Enjoy this conversation with Orioles executive vice president and general manager, Mike Elias. Mike, thanks for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Mark.
You grew up in Alexandria, Virginia, not too far from D.C. The Nationals didn't exist during your childhood. They didn't come into play until you were in your 20s. Were you an Orioles fan growing up?
Yeah, from Northern Virginia. I can't say it was like bleeding black and orange, but that was the local team, and really it was about Cal Ripken and the teams at that time. And certainly, you know, when you're growing up a baseball fan in that area, when you wanted to go see a major league game, you get in the car and you drive up here and you go to Camden Yards. And I have vivid memories of that. The stadium was very new. It was a new experience, this type of stadium. And, you know, the place was packed.
Now, one of the more interesting nuggets I found out about you was researching this. Is your father was a Secret Service agent.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a job most kids have running in their family. Did you get to experience any kind of cool stuff when you were a kid? Thanks to your dad's job?
Yeah, it really was kind of neat, you know, getting to go on White House tours, and he would travel to exotic locations and bring things back when he was traveling with the president. And it was just kind of fun, and really my big takeaway from it was he loved his work and it excited him, and he never felt like he was working even though he had a job to do and he was working a lot. So it made me, you know, appreciate the value in that, and I think was part of the reason that steered me towards trying to get a job in baseball.
You pitched for Yale University 4 years. Did you ever have aspirations of giving a pro career a try?
Yeah, I think everyone does playing college baseball. You know, I was a left-handed pitcher, and I had some feel to pitch a little bit, but I didn't throw real hard. So it was kind of a long shot, you know, maybe the kind of thing where if you have a nice college career, you end up being a senior sign. But you know, looking back now with the scouting perspective and expertise I have, I'm not sure how realistic it was, but, you know, it ended up putting me on a pathway to doing this.
You had surgery to repair a torn labrum while you were there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that experience helps you relate to players when they are dealing with major injuries of their own?
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine how hard it is for elite athletes when you know, their livelihood depends on it. You know, I was a college kid and I was going to a good school, and, you know, even though it derailed my baseball career, I knew it wasn't going to be the end of the world and career-wise. And I also was able to use the time off from that injury to kind of start building towards the front office career. But, you know, it's very jarring and difficult for these guys, especially when they're in the minor leagues and, you know, their hopes or dreams are making it up here. And then suddenly there's a major injury that really threatens that. But it did give me some perspective for the ups and downs of a rehab, how it's not kind of a linear, smooth path. And also you feel a little isolated. You're not with your teammates all the time. You're in the training room doing your own thing. The team's off playing games. So it can be really tough for an athlete.
I've seen you said that reading Moneyball sort of opened your eyes to the idea that you could work in baseball in a front office without having played. When you had that injury and you were rehabbing, is that when that really started to sort of churn in your head as something you thought about as a career?
Yeah, it was exactly the same time. And I almost anyone you talk to that's sort of my age who is working in the sport now, that book had some type of effect on them. You know, it was just such a huge book. I came away with it more interested in the scouting side of it. I'd always had interest in kind of as a pitcher sitting in the dugout, just watching the other players and evaluating the other players. And to me, the interplay between the scouting info and the new information that was becoming available via college statistics mainly was very interesting. And then, you know, at that point in time, a couple of teams, notably the Cardinals, were looking for some less experienced scouts who, you know, could kind of grow into the job. And so I lucked into some opportunity there.
Your first job in baseball actually was with the Phillies, I think, right? You had an internship there that your coach from Yale helped you get. How did that come about, and what did that involve?
I hurt my arm, and in the Ivy League conference, they don't let you play as grad students. So the athletes who want to play all 4 years of their eligibility have two choices. They can either miss the year and then play their fifth year at a different institution, so basically transfer to be a fifth-year senior, a redshirt senior, or you can take a full leave of absence from school. So that's the usual course. So like if a football player blows out his knee but he wants to play all 4 years, he'll take a year leave of absence from class and then come back and you're essentially a fifth-year senior. So I did that, and I wanted to do something productive with the time other than rehab, you know, knowing that I wasn't going to be playing pro ball. I wanted to get in this business. I asked my coach, John Stuper, who was a former major league pitcher, hey, do you got any, you know, help you can lend or ideas? And he said that the traveling secretary for the Philadelphia Phillies, a guy named Frank Copenbarger, who I'm still in touch with today, works, you know, he used to be the Cardinals traveling secretary. And he's like, I know him. I can send him your resume. He can put it in front of the guy who runs the intern program. And he did that. And fortunately for me, it was the year that the Phillies were moving from Veterans Stadium to Citizens Bank Park, so they could kind of use all the help they could get. I went there that fall and sold tickets over the phone and, you know, in spare time kind of cleaned out closets and things in Veterans Stadium. And, you know, it was just the first time around a front office, great experience, first paycheck in baseball, got my resume rolling, and it was just really exciting to, you know, come into a stadium every day when you're that age to work.
Now, as you're starting to think about a front office career, I'm sure you're watching other, you know, front offices. That people didn't cover front offices back then necessarily the way they do now, but were there any executives that you kind of admired from afar as you were watching the landscape of the game?
Well, you know, there was like a whole you know, generation of guys kind of coming up at that time. But, you know, certainly the Kevin Towers, Brian Sabian, Brian Cashman, those were the big names back in the early 2000s, obviously Billy Beane. And they all did things differently. And I would read as much as I could about the types of philosophies they had and the way that they built their staffs and viewed the game. And obviously so much transition has happened since then, but those guys have found a way to continue to be successful through all those years. I find that very interesting, you know, just the openness to different information streams that the successful executives have. And, you know, even in my short, whatever it is, 14, 13 years now, so much has changed. And, you know, I feel like a dinosaur sometimes. So it's impressive to me how these guys manage these huge organizations that are so dynamic.
When a first-year GM is talking about feeling like a dinosaur, that's quite a thing to think about where the industry goes and sort of how fast it moves, right?
Yeah, yeah, especially now. The last 5 years have really been incredibly dynamic. There's just been so much change.
John Stuper once described you as off-the-charts smart. Who's the smartest person you've been around in baseball?
Craig Breslow, the former relief pitcher.
Another Yale guy.
He's now working for the Cubs. Yeah, and, you know, he was a senior when I was a freshman there. And there were a whole bunch of smart guys on that team. John Stites, who was a third round pick of the Brewers, and is now working as a lawyer for McKinsey out in San Francisco. Matt McCarthy, who wrote a pretty widespread book about the minor leagues called Odd Men Out, and he played in the Angels system. So there were a bunch of really smart guys who were also really good baseball players in that team. But I think Brez has to take the crown.
You mentioned you joined the Cardinals in 2007 as a scout. Is scouting something you can learn, or does it have to be something that to some extent comes naturally to a person?
I think there has to be a little bit of a natural eye, but I have seen so many people from so many different walks of life become really good scouts that I'm pretty convinced it's something that you can apply yourself to and really learn a lot of. Now, I think there has to be an internal drive to do it, and like I said, some type of eye for movement patterns or just sizing up people. There have been the varied backgrounds of people that have had really good scouting careers is something fascinating to me.
You mentioned sizing up people. Obviously, you have to have talent for it to matter. But is scouting a player's makeup, especially an amateur player, is that almost as important as what his fastball looks like or you know, what kind of hitting tools he has?
Yeah, it's hugely important. Some of our biggest mistakes and biggest positive surprises in this business are because of the makeup of the player. Judging and predicting human behavior is not an exact science. I think that overall we do pretty well with it as an industry, but there's still a lot of mistakes made. But yeah, there are scouts that I can't believe how well they get makeup right without even meeting or talking with the kid, just kind of watching him go about his business and play one game. I think it's something that's accrued with a lot of experience.
In an interview with Fangraphs about 5 years ago, you said that being an area scout is the best way to learn this job. When you think back to your time in that job, what was your biggest takeaway from that that's helped you as you move forward?
You get to do so much. You're evaluating players first and foremost, but you're on your own. So you have to learn to self-organize and self-start. You deal with a lot of people, coaches, other scouts, players, their families. But also you get experience dealing with agents really quickly, and you get negotiating experience. You actually sign players, so you go through literally living and dying every night with that kid's box score. When you're an area scout, it can be a 24th round senior that you gave $1,000 to, and you're still thinking your job's on the line with every at bat. So it kind of builds up your resistance to the ups and downs of the sport that we all go through, and you know, we all make mistakes with the players that we choose and sign. I think it was a very multifaceted experience in terms of dealing with people, but also evaluating players, writing reports, getting real experience, making decisions, and making mistakes.
Is that when you're dealing with agents as an area scout, and then years later you're dealing with some of those same agents in this role you're in now, do you think back to the time when you maybe first met them? Does it ever come up, you know, that you do have some experience with these people, you know, through the years as far back as being an area scout?
Oh, yeah, yeah. There are people I first talked to when I was an area scout that I still deal with today. And then, you know, as you kind of progress through the scouting ranks and you're cross-checking or you're a scouting director, eventually you end up, you know, touching every agent and agency. And it comes in handy. I mean, you do need to have relationships with these guys. They're a big part of the business. And, you know, we're on different sides of the fence, but we try to deal with each other reasonably and you know, realizing that any disagreements we have aren't personal. It's just everyone's representing the interests that they're hired to represent. So, you know, those relationships help.
I was going to say, it seems like people think about the agents and executives as being an adversarial relationship, but really the relationship you have with them can help you a lot more if it's a good relationship.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I would imagine it's similar between prosecutors and defense attorneys that run into each other every day and bicker over things when they're in the course of doing business. But you realize that everyone's just doing their their job. And I think the fact that we know that we have to deal with one another the next time around, you know, is helpful. But yeah, certainly there are relationships there. There's a lot of good information that one side gets from the other and vice versa. And it's an important part of the business.
So are you the prosecutor or the defense attorney?
Well, I guess it depends on your perspective.
2011, you're still with the Cardinals. They win the World Series. The following year, you go to the Astros. They had lost 100 the year before. They end up losing 218 games over your first two seasons there with Jeff Luhnow. Was it difficult to go from a successful franchise headfirst into a rebuild to the extent that it was?
Yeah, it was such a whirlwind. You know, we were with St. Louis, and at the time, at least we felt like St. Louis was kind of one of the model franchises, you know, with the way that Bill DeWitt continues to run that franchise and where we were at the time. Prime Albert Pujols, the farm system was stocked. We won the World Series, which was kind of a lucky run, barely made it in, and then went on this incredible World Series run and won it. And then Jeff got the GM job with the Astros a couple weeks later, and it moved very fast. Sig Meidel and I were two of his first hires. We followed him to St. Louis, and it was my first time kind of going from one organization to another, and it's exhilarating, but it is really jarring, and it takes a couple of months to get your pronouns straight. The we and the they and the you takes a few months to get out of your system, yeah, it was a really unique opportunity to build an organization almost from scratch. I mean, not totally, but the you know, new owner, the attendance was down, the major league team was down, the farm system wasn't ranked highly, and you know, it was still in the early days of a lot of the quantitative practices that are now real common. At that time, there's probably only like 6 or 7 teams that were really going all in with that. So there was still an opportunity to extract a lot of advantage from that. And Jeff and Sig and I worked really quickly to get that stuff in place.
Your bio with the Astros referred to you as the, quote, driving force, unquote. I'm sure you've heard that several times. Behind the selection of Carlos Correa with the 1-1 pick in 2012. How difficult was that process, given that he was not, I think most publications had him ranked as the 6th or 7th guy in that draft?
Yeah, it was really a risky pick at the time, or perceived to be. It was a perfect storm because of the new draft system, where you realized, hey, if we don't pay the number one pick full slot, we're going to have more money than everyone else in the next couple of rounds. And here's this guy that might be the best player out of this draft class, but everyone thinks he's going 6th or 7th. And he thinks he's going 6th or 7th. And I had just happened to see him a lot. I was living in Florida with the Cardinals and doing Puerto Rico for a couple of years and doing all those tournaments in Florida. And he was there, and you just could see him growing. His body was changing. I saw him do some really freakish stuff, both defensively and just some balls he hit that you just don't see young teenagers hit balls that hard or hit them to those parts of the park. And I just happened to be there for the right games and just had a gut feel about what he was going to turn into. And, you know, we had a tough choice that year. There were some good college pitchers. Mike Zunino was like the safe college bat. And Byron Buxton was this huge five-tool talent. But we just felt really drawn towards Correa. He just felt like he was our guy, and when we were able to get him for $4.8 million and realized we were going to have this war chest to take into the rest of the draft, it was it just felt like the right move.
When you've seen a player since he was 14, 15 years old, and you've seen him grow and develop the way you did with Correa, do you almost get some sort of attachment to that player, knowing that you've sort of, quote-unquote, been with him since the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, when you like him that much, yes, you can get a very deep-seated gut feel. I mean, scouts use that term all the time. as a decision maker, if you're the GM or the scouting director, you have to learn to read your guys and know when they're really feeling it and when to listen to them. And some of the best picks that I've seen made over the years are not because of stats or a draft model. It's because one scout is really sticking his neck out and the decision maker trusts him in this particular instance. And sometimes that guy's wrong the next time. But, you know, there is when that feeling comes out and comes out in a strong way, there's something there. And I just don't know that we can quantify that necessarily.
August of 2016, you're promoted to assistant GM in Houston, which has been open since David Stearns left for Milwaukee. What did that promotion mean to you at the time?
Well, I was really focused on the draft and being the amateur scouting director, and it was so important to what we were doing, and I enjoyed it, and it's all I really knew. But there were starting to be hints of a lot of changes on the player development landscape. Jeff was struggling a little bit to structure that department and find somebody to lead the department who would stimulate the change rather than, you know, maybe slow play it. And so he asked me to take over both of those. And so I did. And I have much less functional expertise in that space, but I'd been around baseball long enough to, have a feel for coaches and what they do and how to best promote or demote or, you know, release players in the minor leagues and those types of decisions. So felt like I was ready for it. He wanted me to do it. I did it. And it ended up being a great experience because it was right at the forefront of what ended up being like a revolution in player development. So I got to kind of a front row seat for that.
When he promoted you, Jeff referred to you as one of the most capable baseball executives he's known. You worked for him for a long time. What did you learn most working for Jeff?
I get this question a lot, and it's hard for me to distill it into a couple of things because up until now he's really the only boss that I've consistently had. So much of what I do has been informed by him. But he has a he's very good at hiring people. He goes through a good hiring processes. When there's a job open, you know, we don't think who do I know that I can give this job to. We try to find the best people. And once he's made a hire, he really stays out of their way, but is available for them and provides them with the support and resources that they need. And if it doesn't work out, you know, he'll move on to another choice. But he has a very good instinct for people, for structures. And I think the thing that has most contributed to his success is he is always looking forward, even when it's uncomfortable to do so. We've never been caught flat-footed under his watch because of that. And he pushes all of us, to do things that are uncomfortable, even when things are going well, just so that we're better positioned for 2 years from now.
What's the biggest challenge in player development in this current era of baseball?
Oh boy! Well,
loaded question.
Yeah, being a farm director is tough because in the middle of the night you've just got to be ready for things. Guys get in trouble. They roll an ankle in the 12th inning, and we got to fly another player up to replace them. So you're never really able to shut off in that job. But now the frustrations come mostly when, we expect these players to just improve linearly, just get better and better, and then these guys have down years, and you're like, what's going on? What can we do? It can be a very helpless, frustrating feeling, and it's always happening with one player or another, so you kind of feel like whack-a-mole, trying to fix the guys that are struggling. But, yeah, it's a really tough job. It's probably one of the toughest jobs in baseball, running the minor leagues.
At what point during the rebuild in Houston did you personally feel like everything was starting to turn and fall into place?
It was a rough road the first few years. In 2014 in particular, we had a lot of bad luck with stuff, and it got pretty pretty heated there. But we had markers along the way that made us feel like we were doing things at least directionally correct. And, you know, the farm system rankings kept going up and the minor league teams were winning a lot. And there was just a lot of positive stories coming out of the minor leagues. And so we knew that the cavalry was coming in that regard. I do remember, you know, Jeff made some moves after the 2014 season with a focus on the big league team for the first time. You know, we traded Rio Ruiz and Mike Fultonevich for Evan Gattis and, you know, a couple other moves, signed some relievers. And the team kind of popped. It, you know, went on a huge April-May start, banked a bunch of wins. And in 2015, all of a sudden, the team had a different vibe and energy to it. And A.J. Hinch was there for the first year. I do remember being in Arizona. We were losing the game, but whoever else we were competing with for that second wild card spot, I can't remember who it was, they lost. And it clinched a playoff berth for us. And I was sitting next to Jeff and saw it on my phone, and it was a moment that I won't forget, just because of how far off that seemed when we first got there and all the ups and downs that had happened to that point.
You mentioned 2014, some things had gone wrong. One memorable moment of 2014 was a certain Sports Illustrated cover that came out. Did that put more pressure on you guys when all of a sudden people are not just noticing that you guys are heading in the right direction, but declaring that you're going to be winning the World Series 3 years from now?
Yeah, that wasn't real popular, nor was it with us. And it, you know, lesson learned there that sometimes the you know, the editors choose the headlines, not the writer, and certainly not the people that are being written about. And you know, they do stuff that's going to sell magazines. And if you read that article, you know, we were merely expressing that we were process oriented, we were focused on the future. We're going to make mistakes, but you know, over time, we're hopeful that this will take us where we need to go. But obviously, you know, there was a lot of focus on the 2017 headline that ended up
being correct. Ben looked like a genius.
So, that was one of the memorable moments of 2017. But now I'm glad that magazine exists, because it's nice to have a copy of it.
Yeah, no kidding. We did an entire podcast last year looking at the events that led up to the Astros trade for Justin Verlander. Seemed like a pretty crazy night from all angles. What do you remember most about that night?
Well, I wasn't much of a part of it. I was at home. It was the August waiver deadline, so it was a midnight deadline. And I was watching TV in my house and texting with Jeff and Brandon Todman and Kevin Goldstein for updates. And, you know, with like 5 minutes to go, it didn't look like it was going to happen. I guess Verlander was thinking about it. And then 2 minutes after the deadline, Todman texted to the group, "Nope, we got him." So, you know, the trade got approved at the last second. He changed his mind or whatever. So I don't have a lot of inside knowledge on that, but I remember being excited about it. And then immediately I had to call Jake Rogers and Daz Cameron and Franklin Perez and the guys that we traded to go over there. Even though it's middle of the night, but you know, for kids today, they've already read that stuff on Twitter by the time you get a hold of them. So that, you know, they're already going through the roller coaster.
I've had some people who were with the Astros at the time tell me that 2015, winning that wild card game at Yankee Stadium, was, you know, as high as they'd ever been in terms of a career highlight. Yet 2 years later, as this incredible playoff run, you win the World Series, you get, you know, clubhouse celebration, parades, etc. What was it like going through that 2017 run, having been there for 5 years and really gone through, you know, the downs of a rebuild?
You know, the 15, like I said, getting in the wild card, and then that win over the Yankees, and even kind of looking like we were going to get past Kansas City, you couldn't believe it, because we were just so used to being an awful team, and then all of a sudden we were doing that. 2017 was a little different feel, because we had a bad year in 2016, relatively, and it kind of toughened everyone up, and I think gave the team a lot of resolve that, hey, we're better than this. We expect to be a good team now. And we made some moves prior to the year to fortify the team, and then getting Verlander at the deadline, it was like, okay, we've got a juggernaut going into the playoffs. And so the expectations were a lot higher. But it was some of the most incredible playoff baseball I've been a part of, and that includes what the Cardinals games of 2011, just the back and forth with the Yankees and the Red Sox, and then that incredible series with the Dodgers. So I mean, at that point, we're just spectators for all that, you just see these unbelievable athletes and competitors just on the biggest stage, and just watching that up close, it's really impressive what these players do.
It must be kind of an odd feeling, whereas during the course of the season, you're watching the games and thinking about how to improve the team, how to deal with certain situations, injuries that come up, etc. Once you get to the postseason, especially the World Series, at least in the first two rounds, you can always look at maybe what you can do differently if you advance. Once you get to the World Series, you're just eating popcorn and watching the games like everybody else.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, but it's nerve-wracking, certainly.
Game seven of the World Series is nerve-wracking?
And your instinct kicks in where you want to try to do something. So I think other front offices probably do the same thing. We get superstitious about where we're sitting and what tie we're wearing and silly stuff like that. But you just want to feel like you have some involvement. But, yeah, we're just watching, and it's all about the players and just to really see what they do that deep into the year and how hard they compete and how at such a high level up close is fun to watch.
So you're more than a decade into your career between the Cardinals, the Astros, been a scouting director, assistant GM. Was being a GM always the goal for you?
No, I would always felt like a scout. My goal was to be more of a scouting director, that was really the only goal to which I really aspired. I think I would have been happy and would continue to be happy doing scouting in some capacity for my whole career.
So you get the Orioles job last November. When you took the job, you said you wanted to build an elite talent pipeline, which is obviously what you guys did in Houston. Is developing your own stars, developing your own players, maybe more important now than it's ever been, given a lot of teams have money, a lot of players don't get to free agency anymore. It's not like you can really solve your problems with free agency the way that you maybe once had to or could. Does that make drafting and developing or signing international players and developing them even more important now than it's been?
Absolutely, and everyone appreciates it now, so everyone's trying to do it, and it's really turned the league into a big scouting and player development contest right now because those young players are so valuable. Player development has gotten so good. College baseball has gotten so good that these guys are getting to the big leagues quicker. They're getting the big leagues better, and you're extracting so much out of these young players that this is an area of emphasis for everyone, but certainly for a team like the Orioles in the division that we're in and the market environment that we're in, this is an area, it's not going to be everything, but we need to be really, really healthy in the talent pipeline.
Shortly after you were hired, you posted what appeared to be your first tweet ever. You'd had an account for several years, but you'd never actually tweeted. And you tweeted a link to open jobs and you wrote, "The Orioles are hiring." I have to imagine that led to quite a wide variety of applicants.
Well, yeah, I don't know.
Because everybody on Twitter thinks they're a better GM than the 30 of you. So
yeah, they might be. But we're going through a lot of changes right now. There are a lot of new jobs here, but also around the industry. I think if you pulled media guides from 10 years ago and read them, the types of positions are a lot different than there are now, and that's how things go and things evolve, and we are in the process right now. It's September, and we're in the process of preparing a whole bunch of job postings right now, new jobs that have never existed with this franchise before, and we're going to cast the net as wide as possible. So it's a big part of front office jobs now is hiring and searching, and it's getting more and more challenging because the skills necessary kind of exist outside of the baseball world. You've got to go out into data science and sports medicine, sports science. You're looking at people who are from university backgrounds, and it requires a lot more resources in order to find and attract these people.
The other thing I noticed looking at your Twitter account on April 4th, which I'm assuming was maybe your home opener or sometime during that week, you tweeted a photo of yourself over at Boog's Barbecue with the words, "Barbecue upgrade," and you CC'd Jeff Luno on there. Did you enjoy sort of being a Twitter troll for one moment there?
Yeah, absolutely. Boog's is Boog's is legit. I recommend it to everybody who comes to Camden Yards. We also have one in Sarasota. I am a big I'm a big meat eater, and certainly got into barbecue in Houston. So it was nice to get here and have an option like that right behind me in the warehouse.
So after you get hired by the Orioles, it's actually after the GM meetings have taken place. Did you feel like you were playing catch up a little bit there? The GM meeting is usually a good spot for all the GMs to sort of take the temperature of other teams and start figuring stuff out, and you didn't start until after those were over.
Yeah, a little bit. We came in and had so much to do right away, and really, you know, the major league coaching staff was vacant. So, you need a manager and you need major league coaches, so I had to get to work on that right away, but also had some areas of emergency in analytics and in international scouting, where we were behind, are behind, and needed to get that rolling right away. So, fortunately for me, I knew Sig was available. I knew Sig was the best in the business, and I knew that with our relationship and going back to two different organizations, he would come with me if I got one of these jobs. So I was able to scoop him up and very quickly and allow him to get rolling on building out that staff and the tools that we're going to need. And then internationally, put some work into looking around the league, who might be the right person to, it's not just any old international scouting job, because we're kind of starting from scratch. You're going to need instant credibility and connections in that market. You're going to need to kind of change the face of the Orioles in that market. And Kobe Perez, who was working for the Indians, really checked all those boxes because he was such a known quantity in the international sphere for 10 years with the Indians and the Phillies. Bilingual, very well respected and trusted, not just by agents, but by other teams in the league, he has very quickly kind of established our presence and has gotten us going. And then the rest of it, we're deep into the winter. It puts you in a little tougher spot with minor league free agents. Some of them are off the board and all that, but it's okay. Sometimes it I think getting a job late like that, it prevents you from trying to do too much right away. And so we proceeded through this year as best we could, and this year we're having a little more time to plan and move with some more care.
I can't remember if it was Thad Levine or Derek Falvey. One of them said that when they took over in Minnesota, and you just jump right into the offseason, it's like drinking from a fire hose.
Yeah.
Is that a good analogy for sort of everything that you have to take care of in such a short amount of time?
Yeah, it's the hours just fly by in the day, and you can't keep up with your correspondence at all. Meanwhile, you're moving, your family's moving. So it's a lot, but you figure out a way to focus on what you need to do to kind of move the ball down the field. And the comfort level grows with time pretty quickly.
I've had some GMs tell me they really enjoy the process of conducting a manager search. I've had others say they dread it. What was your experience like?
I thought it was great. I'd been through two of them with the Astros prior to this. So we talked to so many people on the phone, but we had six in-person interviews here. But they weren't my first six. I'd probably been in on a total of like 20 or 25 manager interviews prior to that. So I'd had some perspective of what feels like a good one, what feels like a bad one, and then what ended up happening. It was sort of a blessing and a curse that we were the last team to interview this past year. But the blessing part of it was that the teams that had just completed their interviews, the five other teams that had just hired managers, they were perfectly willing to share their notes from the interview process. So I was dealing with a short amount of time, but I think we were able to shortcut the process a little bit by getting everyone's finalist lists from the other five teams. We had a great interview process, very extensive. Sig and I mostly handled it. The thing that always impresses me is you realize how these guys got to their point in their careers where they're interviewing for manager spots because they're so impressive in one way, shape, or form or another. You almost never get a dud when you're interviewing a major league manager position. It's just these are coaches that are at the top of their field. So we were so impressed with everybody, but ultimately, Brendan Hyde, with the unique experiences that he had with the Cubs and the Marlins prior to that, checked so many boxes from a resume standpoint, but also felt like somebody that we'd have a good working relationship with and sort of the right guy for this team.
You mentioned that the Orioles were behind analytically compared to other franchises. Did you guys view this situation as an opportunity to basically build that department from the ground up and mold it exactly as you saw fit?
Yeah, I think so. I will be careful to say it wasn't like they were doing nothing, but they'd had some prominent departures right before we had left. And certainly the size and shape and influence over the rest of the organization that the analytics department can and should have, that was not in place and that didn't exist. So we came here. One of the great things about Sig is he's a very practical worker, so he's able to achieve short-term goals in a pretty quick amount of time, get us some kind of minimum viable product pretty quickly, and get us up on our feet. And he hired some good people. We had one really good web developer who was already here named Diju, and luckily he was in place already. And so I think what we have done in that department to catch up and then hopefully position ourselves to kind of join the arms race, so to speak, in a 10-month amount of time has been more than I would have hoped for.
All accounts from spring training and during the season was that your players bought in pretty quickly on a lot of the analytic stuff that you were giving them. How important is it for that to be the case where players are willing to buy in? And B, how important is it to be able to translate some of the information that you're trying to get across to them in language that they can relate to?
Yeah, the second part's the toughest nowadays because there is a skill to coaching and knowing your audience and, how Joey or Johnny receives info and what type of info works the best for him and how to sell him on it and when to present him with the info. Do you do it after you went 0-for-4 with four strikeouts, or do you wait till the next morning, or, those types of decisions? And that's what coaches do and what good coaches are good at. The buy-in has changed so much since when Jeff was running the Astros and we were the most aggressive shifting team, and the pitchers were up in arms every time a ball would go through the shift, and it was a big conundrum. How do we get these guys to understand this is in their best interest? The use of TrackMan to inform your attack plans, that was experimental at the time. But now there is so much success to point to, whether it's the Astros or the Dodgers or all around the league, that I find now that the players, it's almost a reverse dynamic. Like, they're like, hey, front office, this is your job. We're going out there and playing the Dodgers, the Astros, the Yankees, or the Indians, or the Rays. We want to be able to tangle with these guys, help us out. So the buy-in part of it has gone away on a grand scale. But, yeah, there's still a lot of skill and nuance to individual coaching decisions and how to ration the info to players, or whether to ration the info to players.
And it feels like this generation of players is exposed to it a lot earlier as well, right? I mean, the minor leagues, colleges, using TrackMan, using high-speed cameras for pitchers. This is not like people are getting to the big leagues and seeing it for the first time. This generation of players who's coming up, it seems like it's just part of what they do now.
Yeah, at the youth level too. I mean, like, you go to a batting cage now, and they've got cameras, they've got TrackMan, they have wearable vests. This stuff is part of the culture of amateur baseball all the way through college and the minor leagues. So I think this transition, into this technological era of player development, it's going to stop being a transition pretty soon and just be the way things are.
Where do you think analytics has made a bigger impact? With players and their approaches on the field and in-game strategy stuff, or with the way front offices make their decisions?
I think the impact in terms of the way front offices make their decisions is more complete or thorough like that. You know, we're all trying to do more or less the same thing right now with how we make decisions and how we justify decisions, and you know, even in the draft. But the player development and advanced scouting, meaning you know how you're going to play tonight's game, aspect of it is still probably a more of an evolutionary phase. But by the time that's over, it may outstrip what went on at the front office level.
Now that all 30 teams have caught up, obviously to varying extents in the analytic front, how much pressure is there to find that next advantage, that next competitive advantage? And what do you think that might be? Or have you already found it and you're not going to tell me?
It's a lot of pressure because I've seen how powerful they are once you do find them. And it directly led to the Cardinals run that we were on a ride for. It directly led to the Astros run that they're still on. And, you know, I can point to work that happened behind the scenes that directly led to those teams becoming dominant teams for a few years. And I have no doubt that somebody else somewhere, if they haven't already, is going to find something else that's that strong and figure out a way to use it for a couple of years before everyone else catches up. And if I knew what it was, I wouldn't be saying it right now. But, you know, we're not ignorant to the fact of how great all these other front offices and teams and the division that we're in and the resources that other teams have. And it's something that we worry about, but we have to plug away every day and just keep doing what we're doing and work the right way, and hopefully we'll find something.
The Correa pick obviously worked out great for the Astros. You guys drafted Bregman with the number 2 pick in 2015, but a couple of high-profile top picks, Brady Aiken, Mark Appel, didn't work out as well. How difficult is the process when you have the number 1 pick or even a top 5 pick?
It's a gut-wrenching process because you realize how important these decisions are, and you go back and look at drafts from 6-7 years ago. Oh my gosh, if they had just taken so. But at the time, it is not obvious, and you can poke holes in all of the players at the top of the draft. It is never, other than a few years, you know, Alex Rodriguez and a couple of these years, Steven Strasburg, you know, that where it's just unanimous every. Yeah, it goes to show, but it's difficult. But at the end of the day, you try to make the best decision you can. You do as much prep work as you can, and you try to play the odds. And you know, we did have a failure there. We had some really bad luck in another one of the cases. But you know, you learn from that, and the mistakes that you made that led to those, you be sure to include them in your process going forward.
When you came to Baltimore, you knew you had 1-1 in your first year here. You said the decision to take Adley Rutschman was a tough one. You had about 30 people in the draft room offering differing opinions. How do you ultimately make that final call?
You look at all the information in front of you. You listen to all the scouts and evaluators that you've had involved, and you ultimately make what feels to be the right move. But we do have a process where we, I don't want to say we can quantify what our organizational opinion is, but we have a little bit more of a systematic way of weighting all the info and everyone's opinions, but it still ends up very close. And that's why you get these different opinions. You know, ultimately, with him being a dominant college bat that offers defense at a premium position, with really good makeup and really good head on his shoulders, you know, it was tough to pass, and so we went in that direction and feel good about it. And a big part of being the number one pick is being the number one pick, and so he's going to have to handle a little bit more pressure and attention than the guy that went number 2 or 3 or whatever. And so you have to factor in how that player will handle that, and it's definitely one of the things that I've learned, and we think he's extremely well equipped for that because of the way he handled the pressure of being the presumptive number one pick all year, and you know, leading Oregon State to its championships, and just the way he was raised and the way he was wired. But you know, we'll see. It's a long path forward, but I think we had a terrific process and pretty hopeful that the outcome's good.
I'm sure you've experienced a number of firsts this year in this job, one of which was being in the big chair for the trade deadline. You ended up not making any major moves. What was that two or three week or 4 week process leading up to the deadline, first time in this job, like for you?
Yeah, it's informative. You know, there are so many conversations that happen, and 90% of them, 99% of them lead nowhere. But you get some information out of all the conversations that you have. And in our position, we weren't going to just trade players just to trade them if we really didn't feel like the return was going to advance our strategic goals of kind of elevating the whole overall level of talent in the organization. You know, the one pending free agent that we had that was a trade chip, we did trade, but the guys that we didn't trade are remain under control and on the team and are nice players to have. And so we want to be a little bit more careful with moving them. But it was a challenge this year in that, you know, new to the organization, not the infrastructure that you'd want or will that we will have going forward, and so you know you're dealing with a little less organization and information that you want when you're making decisions like that.
You went through a couple of hundred lost seasons in Houston when you first got there. Even though you understand that losing is going to happen at the start of a rebuilding process like this, when you go through a season like this, does it wear on you?
Oh yeah, it's tough. I mean you see how hard the players work and the coaching staff works, and you want to win as much as possible. And the you know, when the team wins, I'm in a good mood. And when the team loses, I'm in a bad mood. And the coaching staff at the major league level, even though intellectually they understand where we're at, you know, they still spend so many hours a day preparing for that night's game. And even if it's not their fault, they feel like it was a failure when they lose that night's game. So it's tough, and it does test, you know, your metal, and I think that's why Brandon's experience and front office perspective will be helpful for him, you know, kind of knowing what's on the other end of the rainbow and understanding that, you know, we all understand that this team is going to go through some lumps.
Were there any lessons that you took from those first few years at Houston that you've been able to bring with you here as you go through a similar process?
I hope so. I mean, obviously the patience, but it takes some toughness. This stuff isn't easy. Things go poorly, and you know you get some bad turns, and you know it requires some thick skin and some you know, confidence in the direction, and some patience. And I think everyone in the organization needs to understand that. And we did a really good job of keeping our eye on the ball in Houston through some tough times. You know, certainly it's toughest on the major league manager and the GM.
You've let about 25 people in various roles go during the past month. You mentioned you're going to be doing a lot of hiring in the coming weeks and months. When you took over, did you have a vision of the type of operation you wanted to put together? And does it take a year to kind of evaluate what you have and who you've inherited?
Well, I knew coming from Houston, where we had just undergone quite a bit of restructuring to position ourselves for the landscape, the information landscape, the technological landscape that exists today in baseball. I knew what that looked like, and it wasn't something that we just winged it. We put a ton of study into it. We had outside help take a look at how a baseball operations department should structure itself, what's needed, how to apportion resources. And so I really, coming off of that experience, fresh off that experience, had an idea of what today's front office can and should look like. So I was prepared for that change. But, you know, certainly some of it is personnel based. And, you know, we're in a phase where, you know, this organization is, you know, going through a downturn. And, you know, there are times when, you know, change and bringing in fresh perspectives, new voices, new blood is the right thing to do. So I think with all of that combined, you know, we decided to do this stuff. You know, it wasn't something that we take lightly. But, you know, we're looking to the future, and this is the right course for this organization going forward.
When you made the recent changes, you said the organization's in the process of, quote, adapting to the sport today. This is probably a loaded question that could be its own podcast. But how do you think the sport has changed the most in the past 5 or 10 years?
It's information, and it's, you know, any revolution that has taken place like it or not, has been, and I understand the criticisms of the entertainment aspect of the sport being changed and the human element being reduced. And I can't say that I'm a fan of it either, but we're in a competitive business and we're trying to win games. Any one of these changes has been brought on by technology, and even the sort of the quote unquote money ball using college stats in the draft from the early 2000s, that really wasn't possible until the internet put those stats out there so easily and so readily and so consistently. And it's just an example of these changes being brought on by technology. And now we have so much in terms of tracking the bat and the ball on the field and the players' bodies and what they're doing. And there's so much information coming out of that. And some teams are starting to figure out ways to really precisely deploy that info to improve players and to win games, that the skill sets of people that are needed to make decisions, they have to be able to incorporate that info and understand it and want to use it and want to find it. It doesn't mean that other skill sets that have been around longer are gone or not necessary anymore, but we need to make room for this new skill set too.
Last two questions for you. You've gone through your first draft with the Orioles. You've gone through your first international signing period. Did you come away from those two things feeling like you'd accomplished what you wanted to move forward with this process?
Yeah, we're trying to raise the overall level of talent in the organization. Those two avenues are the biggest ways that we have and can and will do that. I think we did really well in both counts, especially with the July 2nd, with how late of a jump that we got and kind of playing from behind. I still think we got some real good players and got our program rolling. But I always remind myself that the Yankees and Red Sox get to draft and sign players too. So, while it feels like we're adding talent, other teams are adding talent as well. It's a tough race, but it's a very important part of what we're doing, and we're going to need to excel in those areas.
You were 9 months old the last time the Orioles won the World Series or even appeared in one. Having grown up, as we mentioned before, not all that far from here, do you have a sense of what it would mean to bring a title back to Baltimore?
I can't even imagine it, because this town is amongst the most passionate baseball cities I've ever seen, especially now that I live here and really see it up close. The people really love this team, and it reminds me probably mostly of St. Louis of any place, with the type of connection between the town and its baseball team and the history. And there's been some lean years. We're in as tough a division as there is, I think that would be unbelievable. And you saw what in 2014 with the run that they had, the way that the stadium was going crazy, and the town rallied behind the team. And I just think it would mean a lot to the city right now to get this club back to the playoffs in some way, shape, or form. But we're gonna be focused on the process to get there, and I don't know when it's going to happen. I can't put a number of years on it, but I know what we have to do to get there, and that's what we're going to worry about.
Mike, appreciate your time. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks, Mark.
Many thanks to Mike Elias for taking the time to sit down for this week's episode of Executive Access. Coming up in our next episode, I'll sit down with Brewers Farm Director Tom Flanagan to discuss his beginnings in Milwaukee's clubhouse, the challenges of scouting, the Brewers' resurgence, and much more. You can search for Executive Access on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Art19, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. So be sure to subscribe and enjoy these conversations all season long. If you like what you hear, leave us a review while you're at it. We always appreciate those. And be sure to spread the word and tell all the baseball fans in your life about Executive Access. Until next time, I'm Mark Feinsand.